session number 9927, reel 2.
Lieutenant Colonel Hemsley, reel 2.
While we were stationed in Windsor, we lived in the Pleasant Road in billets. And in the opposite billet, our corporal said, "I must tell you a strange story." He said, "Last night, there's an old gentleman in my billet who goes off quietly and has never told me anything about his job. He puts his bowler hat on, he departs every morning. But apparently he's something in the castle. And he asked me whether I would help him. And I said, I've no objection. And from under the kitchen cupboard, he produced 24 little brass cannon, which we set to work and polished, spent the evening on it. Then he went down to the grocer's and borrowed the grocer's barrow, and we piled these 24 guns on the barrow, and I helped push it up to the castle, and the sentry opened the gates and through we went, and then he put these 24 cannon all along on the lawn in front of the king's bedroom facing away and returned the barrow, and that was that. But the next morning at 8 o'clock you heard a 21 gun salute, and I presume the majority of people in Windsor and everybody else concerned imagined field guns standing in a row and all banging, so on. Actually, it was the old gentleman going around touching them off one at a time. And the next evening, they went and collected them, got the baker's barrow again and took them back, put them under his cupboard in the kitchen in readiness for the next royal wedding, and a royal birthday. And that was the interesting story to me, because I don't think anybody knew, except myself and a few of us, that the famous cannon were nothing but little fellows that he laid there every occasion.
If I could, I'd like to ask you now, you know, because I think we've reached the point where you're due to go overseas.
Mm-hmm.
The reaction of your family and friends to you going off to the war, how did your parents take this? You know, obviously they knew you were a soldier in 1911, didn't they? But now you were involved with World War.
Yes, because there again we have another point I was writing to you about here. Yes, we were finally at our barracks in Croydon, and we were marched off and entrained to Devonport, and here we went on board the Ulysses, an old Australian cattle boat.
But were your parents upset, you know, with you going?
Ah. Well, I think they assumed it should be so, although my father always had had a grudge against my joining the territorial, because he said they never had a soldier in the family, and the only soldiers they ever knew were some red-coated fellows who came home drunk and were taken to the police station and so on. So he didn't like to think I'd mix with a crowd like that. But that, of course, was when the regulars came home individually on furlough. But once it was settled, I had no more arguments at all. I mean, my father and parents and family were all interested. They were rather intrigued. One thing, in those days, the territorial was given his rifle to take home and to look after, so that you always had a rifle about the house, and of course I was always polishing up my buttons and keeping my uniform in good order. And then of course we had regimental dinners and interests like that. We had rifle shooting, as I say, competitive rifle shooting, and there were many interests, and they all landed on one evening's drill a week and our fortnight's camp, which we very much enjoyed.
I interrupted your story about going overseas. You know, if you could now take me back to Devonport. And,
well, from then, of course, we piled onto this ship, the whole of our battalion, and a large number of Welshmen as well, and we were all sent below into the hold, which had been carrying hides and things from Australia for many years and smelt abominably. But there we all had to get accustomed to sleeping in hammocks closely packed together, and under the hammocks were the tables at which we had our food, and on the table were all the mugs and metal equipment that we used. And almost every night one of the men fell out of his hammock and landed on the table and the crockery.
Had you any idea where you were going? Had you been told anything?
No, we had no idea where we were going. First we went to Malta. We stopped there for 2 or 3 days, but the troops were not allowed to land, only the officers. Then we went to Alexandria. The same applied there, except that we were taken for route marches in Alexandria, but not to stop or to speak to the Egyptians. We were berthed next door to a German... No, I beg your pardon. We were berthed next door to a Russian battleship, then one of our allies. It had 5 funnels, so naturally it was known as the Woodbines. And the Russians were very sociable people, I gather, and they invited all the best people of Alexandria to dinner parties on the decks, with something like 500 of us hanging over the edge, watching every move. Balalaika, music playing, but it was really very unpleasant, I think, for these unfortunate visitors to have a whole gang of troops watching the whole time, and occasionally joining in with some conversation about them. That was just a minor point. We left there after a few days and sailed on to Mudros, the Isle of Mudros.
Had you been given special kit, you know, to go to a different part of the world? You know, and did that give you a clue?
Yes, I forgot to mention that, because we were equipped when we left for Devonport. We were dressed in light drill uniforms and pith helmets. These large white pith helmets that you see in pictures of the South African War. Of course, you must bear in mind that we always seem to carry on with the war before we really settle down to the existing war, so we all went with these helmets. They had a pagri around them, the Indian name for it, which was supposed to stop sunstroke, but was extremely difficult to fold around the helmet, and we had to pay the old Indian soldiers who were amongst us, I think it was a shilling a time, to put the folds and do the thing correctly before we went on parade. And we went to fight the Turks with these wretched things on too, was bad.
Also, when you were on the journey, was there any threat from either surface craft or submarines?
There was anxiety regarding submarines, but fortunately we never had an attack. We got safely through to Malta, we got safely through to Egypt without any trouble. Mind you, they were always on the lookout for it.
When you arrived at Mudros, were you told anything about the campaign which you were to participate in?
No. Not only we were not told, we didn't know what was going to happen. It was so secret. And the point about it is that the Greek bum boats, as they call them, you know, boats that go around selling food and that kind of thing, were mixing amongst us the whole time, and they must have found all they ever wanted to tell their Turkish friends. We should never have known. A lot of those things could happen, you know. Seems rather sad. But anyway, after a few days at Mudros, in which we were not allowed to land, the ship once again started to sail out of the harbour, and to our rather surprise, all the sailors on the ships there were cheering us all the way along. He thought, well, it's very nice of them. But we'd no idea why they were cheering us, what we'd done to deserve it. And actually, we didn't know that we were going to fight at Suvla Bay. Because Suvla Bay was an interesting thing when you have to look at the map. And after those terrible battles at Helles and at the Australians at Anzac, here, further away from them, was a fairly open area. And this big salt lake, to start from the beginning, there was a low hill which gave a cliff, which was rather useful, because under that cliff you were safe, reasonably safe from shell fire and so on. And the other side of that was this lake spreading for a mile or so in every direction. It was nothing but, at that time, dry sand. So
That's a sort of Suvla area, to give me some idea. You were mentioning the Helles, the terrible business at Helles, you know, in Anzac. Had you heard of that? Did you know what had been happening on the peninsula?
We must have known, but of course, on the other hand, nobody told us where we were going to go to. The officers were told, but it was never told to us. And I didn't know for the first two or three days that we were fighting Turks and that we were on a piece of Turkish land. Because I was a sergeant by then, but nobody was told anything, really.
Could I ask you about the sort of stages? First of all, of going to the Suvla area, you know, how you reached that. Was it in the same boat?
Oh, yes.
It was. And how you, when you arrived at the beach, what time of day would that have been?
It was in the night. We drew our big ship. It was a big ship. It drew in near the shore in daylight. And then that night, they put on a timber gangway, narrow gangway, to get to the shore. And I understood that one of our men fell off and was so loaded up, as we all were, with extra bandoliers of ammunition and so on, that he went straight to the bottom. We never saw or heard any more of him. That was lost another one.
Did you get into landing craft to reach the beach?
No. We kept on this long, narrow plank stretched right the way across onto the beach. And having landed there, we were put amongst the sand dunes and laid down there. In fact, some of us went to sleep.
Yes. What date would that have been when you actually landed? Can you remember?
No. I honestly can't. It was 1915 August, I think, but I ought to know that. I know, but I don't remember it. I don't think I've ever noted it.
Well, would it have been the main landing at Suvla on the 6th of August, do you think?
It was the main landing, yes.
It was the main landing.
Yes.
Yes. And can you remember which beach you would have landed at? Did it have a name or, you know, any identification?
I think it did have a name. Yes, we landed at A Beach, and then we spent the night lying in the sand dunes waiting for daylight. When the daylight came, we fell in and were ordered to pick up picks and shovels, and one small man found himself with a long 5-foot crowbar to carry. We'd only gone a short distance, now just starting on our journey across the salt lake, when a staff officer dashed up and said, "You can drop those, you're here to fight, not to dig." And so we all put the stuff down and carried on marching. We formed a clear long lines, 10 feet apart, crossing the salt lake with the colonel in the front line. And
could you tell me, when you were marching like this in your columns, what was the scenery like, the terrain like? I wonder if you could give us some idea of what that area looks like.
Yes. Well, the first thing was, as I say, the salt lake was a large plain of sand, nothing more, the other side of which the land arose onto this one here, Chocolate Hill. And that had already been taken by the 29th Division in front of us. And here we, on our way across, I saw the colonel was halted by a messenger running across with a message to him. And the messenger handed it over and fell flat on his face dead in the ground, which was our first casualty. Because the whole of the time while we were going across there, not noticing anything wrong, there was a hissing sound of the bullets from the Turkish side falling amongst us without us even knowing what the noise meant. And that was our first casualty. And then we arrived at the actual first trench there, which had been already captured. Here I found in the trench a Turkish officer's rule book, all of course in Turkish. I kept it for 70 years and I sent it this year to the Turkish ambassador, who has sent me a very charming letter, which I can show you, thanking me for letting him have this. Well, they try to find out what's happened to that officer.
So, this landing and crossing the Salt Lake, this would appear to be that there would appear to be some Turkish resistance. Would you describe it as an operation? Were you actually fighting you went across and found these trenches?
We were under fire.
You were under fire, yes.
And the first line of trenches, which had been the Turkish trenches, had been taken, by the troops there before us. And as they went on up the hill, we followed them up through the trees. Here, I must admit, I had my first sight of dead bodies lying around, which was something new. And we then were getting fewer and fewer in numbers until the few in the front were beginning to drop back. But fortunately at this stage, our second in command, Major Hull, came with his revolver in his hand and said, make a halt here, dig wherever you are. And so that's where we began to dig the front line. During this period, despite digging down, we were losing men and they were all being shot in the head. And it dawned upon me that this firing was coming from above. And so my machine gunner, called Private Rabbits, one of my own recruits, I told him to turn his gun over the trees, and he swept the trees all around us with machine gun fire, and the Turkish snipers fell down from the trees almost like ripe fruit. And from then on we were a little less trouble with this appalling sniping that was doing so much harm. Unfortunately, Rabbits, having done his good work like that, he then set his gun up, stood up for a moment, and they shot him through the head, and that was the end of him. Pity about that. Well, now, at that stage, we were now digging ourselves in as far as we could get up the hill.
This would have been, of course, what you've been describing, the attempt to gain the heights.
Yes, right, yes.
In Suvla Bay.
Yes. You see, they had gained Chocolate Hill, but where they've marked that place called Green Hill, we never managed to get any further.
And that was your objective, was
yes,
it?
That was
to get
our
further,
final,
yes.
Final objective.
Yes.
But quite frankly, you've got those names there. I've heard those names, but of course we didn't know the name. Nobody told us on the spot this is now Chocolate Hill or anything like that. We lost our officers, at least as far as I know, we lost our junior officers almost at once. And that's why I was a sergeant in charge or in command of a platoon.
Yes. Do you think when you look back on that operation, the attempt to gain the heights beyond Salt Lake, that there was a lack of exploitation of what had been achieved? Could more have been done at the time, so far as your position was concerned? Or do you think...
It definitely could have been. Whether we were so inexperienced as soldiers that we were unable to make the best of the occasion. But I met three soldiers coming down towards us from the enemy's side, and they were of the 29th Division. They said they had got right to the top and they had seen down to the sea beyond them and the town below, but they had no ammunition, There was nobody else with them, and so they just had to retreat and come back again. They're the only people I ever knew who had actually seen our final destination, which we never reached.
And you saw those at this very early stage?
Yes,
you know,
just when the operations were in full effect. We were now busy digging in as told. You see.
Yes. Do you, when you look back, you know, and at the time even, did you feel it was a confused situation at all?
Oh, yes, we certainly did. We'd lost our officer, we didn't know why we were going there, and we didn't know where we'd got to get to. In other words, we knew we'd got to carry on forward, but we'd no idea that we'd got to climb up more or less cliffs and things like that to get past that very heavy line of mountains along here, which we were unable to pass. Yes.
And am I right in thinking that you'd had no sort of briefing about the sort of terrain you were going to face and the operation that lay ahead of you? Were you not briefed, you know, about what to expect?
We were not, because of the simple reason that none of us knew where we were and why we were there.
Were you aware that the Turks were reinforced, you know, quite early on? I think about the 8th of August, weren't they? Were you aware that Turkish reinforcements had come up?
Well, we shouldn't know that. All we should know, perhaps, is that there was a greater amount of shell fire and bullets flying. You're quite right, because in the history of the story, the opportunity was very great at that stage if we'd got just a little more power to push on. We were completely exhausted. Mind you, there were a lot of strange things happened. For one thing, the captain of the ship, Ulysses, would not allow the troops to use their boots on his polished decks. And so most of our journey there, we were wearing our rubber shoes. So when we put our heavy army boots on, our feet were not really ready for it. Worse than that, the medical people at the last moment said that any man who had refused vaccination in England was no longer allowed to do so. So those who had not been vaccinated in England will now be vaccinated. And so they went. I know the sergeant next to me had got a much swollen arm here where he'd been reached the worst part of it. So that both those conditions were the kind of thing that made our landing uncomfortable and were undesirable.
What was the morale like, would you say then, of the force that landed on that?
Oh, I think there was nothing wrong with the morale. We did as we were told. We were here to fight a war, and there was no turning back, except at the one moment of the battle when we reached the end of our tether, in which the major just took control and held us there. We never left it there after that. We just dug our way in, you see. Later on, we had other movements and so on, but the main trench line got there and it never moved.
Yes. Were you reinforced after that? You know, did reinforcements come?
Yes, they kept coming. We lost all our officers by one way or the other. You see, this sickness was very great there, apart from wounds. And so we had reinforcements.
Because I was wondering also, you know, you were near the Anzac, weren't you? The junction
yes.
with Anzac. Were you aware of the Australians? You know, did you see
or interact
with
them at all? You wouldn't see what was happening the other side there. I mean, from here you couldn't see anything here. But on the other hand, our trenches joined up with the Anzacs, and we used to exchange friendly greetings, and they used to come along our trench. In fact, I must stop for a moment to tell you that the odd patches of water, of which there was very little anywhere there in the heat, that strangely enough had tortoise of all sizes. And we found a yellow one, a bright yellow one. So we carved on the back, or rather really with indelible pencil, we put our badge. And that was our mascot. But our mascot would persist in going to the Australians. Overnight, they'd walk along the trench and disappear. And then in the morning, you'd have an Aussie coming along with his hat over one eye and say, we brought it back again. So there'd be a little bit of fun backwards and forward on that particular line with the Australians and ourselves, the best of friends, of course.
After this initial push, you know, up to that position, Were you involved with any other operations, you know, trying to go forward?
Well, once we moved forward, but even that has, I regret to say, more of a ludicrous aspect, because we were told to dig, and we dug trenches with our entrenching tools, and then somebody, possibly there'd been a shell drop the other end, because the order was we were to move along so that we should have crawled into the next man's trench and so on. But there was a little conversation going on next to me, and that was the sergeant major, and everybody else had moved along. And then a man said, "Do you know, there's money here." He said, "I think it must be Roman money." He said, "It's black." And he produced three or four coins like this. So he passed them to the sergeant major, and he said, "Look what I've found." And the sergeant major said, "That's a half a crown." I said, "I know what it is. It's a hole in my pocket." He said, "I dug that hole, lost all my money there, unbeknown, and I've left it there, and now you've dug it out again." A silly episode, but there it is. One of those silly things you remember. May I remember yet another one of those things in the trenches? We just arrived at the first trench, and one of our men had been given a periscope to carry, of which he had no idea what it was for, and so we told him that he had looked through that and he could see over the trench and see what was happening in front. So he stood there, or hanging back there, looking through this with care. He said, "I can see water." "Oh, good." He said, "I can see a big ship." He said, "Oh, you silly, you're the wrong way round." So we turned him round, and of course all he could show us then was bushes and trees.
Did you have more periscopes later? You know, did other people make them or have them?
Never saw them again. No, I think we had other methods in France better than that. Yes. I mean, we had...
I'll ask you about France later on. But I was wondering, you know, were there any other... You know, was it a question of really stalemate and trench warfare after this initial operation?
Yes.
Or did you actually... were you engaged in any other big push?
Well, and there wasn't a big push, but I was a witness of a very sad push, because near to us were a Welsh brigade, a battalion, and for some reason they decided that they would have a daylight attack on the Turkish trenches above.
Yes, what position would that have been? Green Hill.
Green Hill. And we watched them go through us and beyond, and one by one dropping either shot or taking cover. And the last small remnant with one officer were just giving a feeble cheer and dashed the last section to the Turkish trench, but They were shot down, and gradually what there was left of the battalion came back one by one from the various spots where they're trying to shoot or take cover. And the old colonel came back and lay beside me quite unexpectedly, and he was crying bitterly at the loss of his battalion. When they got back to the seashore, probably were half of them left again, but the attack had been a failure. Very sad sight, one I've never forget.
It would seem from what you have said that the Turks had a tremendous advantage, you know, having those heights.
They were on the heights indeed, yes. We never got up to a height in which we could command them, neither did the Australians, and they had a worse position trying to get to their front line, as you might say, because they had that frightful gully to fight their way up. We at least had the whole of this Salt Lake.
Did you feel very exposed, though, where you were, you know, dug in? Did you know that they could probably see every movement if you poked your heads up?
Oh, yes, we knew that pretty soon. We learnt that only too soon with those we lost. Poor Fatty, one of our soldiers who just got in front of our line, and they shot him and he lay there. And it got terribly hot. We didn't know what to do about him. We heard him cry and die. And so we said, we can't leave poor old Fatty out there. And so we dug rather shallow trench behind the line, and after dark we went and fetched him in and we laid him in the trench, but he was stiff and we couldn't get his arm in. With some difficulty eventually we managed to bend his arm in, cover it over, and that was the burying of poor Fatty. I've forgotten his real name, but we only knew him as Fatty. That was one of those sort of tragic moments that still stick in my mind.